the same type of information there. We are going to start today with my guest, Claus. So Claus, welcome to the show and thank you for joining me. Can you please introduce yourself?
Sure, thank you, John. Yeah, I'm Claus Mega. I live in Bend, Oregon, and I retired from a lifetime in the food business. Now, I actually started as a chef. I'm a fourth generation chef. I've come from Germany, so I came to the United States in 1976. And ended up working as a director of food and beverage for the Walt Disney Company. I was leading teams to open Disney's California food system for Disney's California Adventure and then for Hong Kong Disneyland. And then the last 5 years of my corporate life, I worked for an international food wholesaler, Metro Cash and Carry, based in Düsseldorf, headquartered. So I had the great fortune to take my kids to Germany for finish up their school. They lived in Hong Kong for 5 years and then in Germany for 5 years, going through their education, but also getting to know my culture, you know, my home, my base culture. So I worked there as a corporate head of target group marketing and I had teams in 30 countries. And so I was intricately engaged in developing systems that to develop segmentation strategies to address specific customer groups. And I would conduct training. I would do country audits in India, in Russia, in China, in Turkey, in Germany, in France, 30 countries. Mm-hmm. And it gave me a really good perspective on the food system from the start, where does your food come from to how do you deliver it?
Is your education in culinary or is it in business, like your as far as your university education?
Well, at university I actually took industrial engineering, crazy thing, but that was totally suitable to my specific talent, So I started culinary, but then I became like an industrial engineer building the huge restaurant systems. Disneyland, for example, has the capacity to serve something like 13,500 meals per hour, 3 hours sustained, mm-hmm. across a platform of hot dog stands to fine dining in Club 33. So these are very complex systems, to develop the supply chain, to feed this, to develop staffing and operational controls and so on. So I was basically, became a business person. And then I became a strategist because in the last 10 years or so with the Walt Disney Company, I was strategizing how to develop food systems that complement the creative intention of, let's say, Disney's California Adventure, right? So I would think of Fisherman's Wharf and Mexican restaurants and Chinatown and so on to express the creative intent of Disney's California Adventure. And in Hong Kong, we were building a Chinese-Asian food system to complement the environment of Hong Kong Disneyland.
Yeah, that makes sense, and I think some people get too boxed in sometimes with their educational choice, and because a lot of times there's so many transferable skills that you can apply to other aspects of your career, like how you took your systems thinking and engineering and applied it to the supply chain. So that's really good that you were able to do that and be so successful. Can you help link then from your career doing supply chain management and looking at the food system, and how did you get interested in regenerative agriculture there from there?
So I retired in 2012 and I wanted to work as a consultant. In fact, I did work as a consultant for a while, but then every project I got was another theme park somewhere. I did the original creative for Universal Studios Beijing and for Motion Gate Dubai and so on. But anyway, I took a class. I just wanted to educate myself, and I had heard about sustainability and I didn't really know what was meant by that. And so I took a class at University of Illinois which they had put online. That was like one of the first classes taken in Coursera. At the time, they had like maybe 18 universities. Today, they have 150 or so. No, and it's just, and there are other networks that have sprung up, you know, like X. Anyway, so I took that class, and there were over 70,000 students that had enrolled there from all over the world. Very lively chats and so on, and the class was going through stages of water. Now, what's the water cycle? What's the carbon cycle? Population growth and so on, and it was just basically presenting statistics of what is happening to the environment and to the globe, to the natural world. And it just struck me because, I mean, I was trained to deal with metadata. That's, you know, I mean, at Metro Cash and Carry, the area I was responsible for as a strategist did 13.5 billion euro in sales. So we were looking at, when I was working with big data. So I looked at what came out of this and I was just shocked. I mean, it was just insane to see how we are depleting the natural resources. So that set me on a journey then. So in the meantime, I've taken a course at Columbia University with Jeffrey Sachs, you know, at MIT with Otto Scharmer on Theory U. So I've taken probably a couple of dozen courses to immerse myself in this topic, and I became increasingly alarmed, right? Because we're really running out the clock. So I tried many times, you know, to link up with my former professional connections. No one had any interest. No one had any interest to even look at this data. So I joined NGOs. I joined Citizen Climate Lobby. Became the sector leader agriculture for business climate leaders. Then I connected with the Sierra Club as a mission, you know, to connect with other NGOs. And then I'm a core team leader in the core team of the Food and Agriculture Grassroots Network team. And I represent all three organizations with the 4 per 1,000 initiative, which has been initiated by the French government. And it's actually part now of a United Nations effort to focus food systems on climate change, to link, you know, the recovery of food systems with climate change. So by now it is entirely clear, you know, that we cannot solve climate change without first solving the food system, because about 1/3 of carbon emissions are directly or indirectly linked with the food system. So even if we were to go carbon neutral in the energy systems tomorrow, we would continue, you know, to deplete soil of carbon and use synthetic nitrogen fertilizer, which is made with natural gas, and pesticides, which are made with oil. Yeah? So we would continue this. So we have to change the food system. And the beauty of it is that not only can the restoration of agriculture move down to carbon neutral, it can go carbon negative, because the soil has the capacity to absorb carbon out of the atmosphere through photosynthesis. And the soil actually contains 2 to 3 times as much carbon as there is in the atmosphere. So carbon belongs into the soil, and there has to be almost a designed level of carbon in the atmosphere to regulate the climate inside, the temperature inside the planet.
Right. And I did watch, as I mentioned to you, one of your videos on your channel, and you provided a very concise and easy to absorb piece on those statistics that you were reading from your original research, which was really, really helpful. And you're right that when you hear those statistics, it is alarming, and you feel the sense of urgency that this movement needs to be implemented with. I am wondering though, Disney specifically is very big on sustainability. Do you feel that when you were working with them and in the food supply chain, that you didn't have much exposure to the regenerative agriculture movement at that time just because it was too far away from actual farming? Or why do you feel like it didn't it wasn't part of the system you were working in previously?
I mean, this is
It could be just a new movement as well. I'm not really sure of the history of it, of how new regenerative agriculture is. So maybe it's just that it's somewhat of a new technology that's being adopted as well. I'm just wondering, why the bigger industry hasn't had ex quite as much exposure to it yet.
So yeah, I mean, this is a complicated topic. We are basically going back to the future, right? I mean, regenerative agriculture is agriculture that is biblical. I mean, the Jewish people recognized, you know, 3,000 4,000 years ago that you have to treat the soil as a living thing. So you have to let it rest every 7th year. You know, you can't put the same crop into it over and over. So over, you know, thousands of years, the Jewish people have developed a diet, you know, food preferences that are harmonized with the needs of the nature. So when you look around the world and you look at cultures that have lived on the same land without destroying their soil for thousands of years, the Japanese, the Vietnamese, the Chinese, you know, the Germans, the Italians, and so on and so on, they have created, empirically, you know, through trial and error, a system where they grow things that are complementary to the soil, because each crop takes different nutrients out of the soil. So if you put the same crop in over and over, it depletes the soil until it's empty of those types of nutrients. So what happens in the United States? We are being, you know, the country of no limits and no history. Now, with the invention of synthetic nitrogen fertilizer, which was actually coming out of the war machine, right? I mean, that was the, those were chemicals used in warfare. They discovered that if you use synthetic nitrogen fertilizer, which is made from natural gas, now you have a concentration of carbon that you can put into the soil that just blows up the crop, because it's just like it's like putting nature on cocaine, right? It's just a rush. The problem, of course, is that over time, it kills off all the microbial life inside the soil. So then you're starting a race against nature, because now you have to defend your crop against pesticides, against insects, against weeds that are getting ever more aggressive. So you have to use now pesticides and start poisoning the soil so that nothing else can live other than your crop. Then you have to make your crop immune against these poisons. You know, so it created an insane cycle that is outside of nature, basically at war with nature. And when I came into this role, you know, as a decision maker in food systems there, I mean, I had no idea. I mean, literally had no idea what was going on. But at the time, the entire food industry, this corporate machine there, created a vertically integrated supply chain. Indeed, that is complementary. You know, they all rely on each other. So you have Monsanto, you know, which develops crops and chemicals to grow these crops, and then you have Cargill and Tyson and other companies up the supply chain who use these highly customized products to process them into foods that have high, long shelf lives, and which then can be used like on an assembly line in restaurants. I mean, you look at restaurant chains with like 30,000 retail outlets, all basically featuring the same menu.
Yes.
But inside the restaurant, they can't cut a tomato. There is no provision to do anything fresh, right? Everything comes out of the freezer, or it comes ready to use from a commissary place outside. know, tomatoes are pre-sliced, whatever salad they put on there, but it's basically the buns and everything. So I started to get into, to become more conscious of it when I went to Hong Kong, because in Hong Kong, I had to do the supply chain myself. You know, when I was working in California, there was an existing procurement department. I mean, I said, I want to open up this specialty sausage stand. And 2 days later, I had 90 sausage samples now in the kitchen. But in Hong Kong, I had to find vendors, first of all. And then I had to personally approve every single vendor from a food safety standpoint and from a labor compliance standpoint, you know, that they were in compliance with international labor regulations. And so I started learning about how these food factories work. And it was just like, you got to be kidding me kind of thing, right? I mean, you make chicken nuggets out of chicken skin, parade chicken skin, you know, with some specks of trimmed breast meat that goes in there. I mean, it was just like, you got to be, are you serious? So they took meat from milk cows that died of old age, basically, and were so lean, had no fat on them. And then they would import fat from Australia, where they would grow cattle for steaks, right? And they had surplus fat. So then they would plant this fat from Australia into the cows from China, so they have 20% fat in the burger. I mean, all this crazy stuff. Yeah. But you are when you are working in this corporate environment, you know, you are stuck inside a system that is so closed. The supply chain is simply not configured, know, to step outside of this industrialized food. I had like no idea until I retired and started educating myself on what is sustainability and how does that work. So the idea of regenerative agriculture is basically, you know, this is how we farmed for 10,000 years, right? To keep the soil alive is always the focus, to keep your soil alive and productive. And we just lost that in the United States. Our form of agriculture is destructive. So globally, in the last 40 years, the world has lost one third of its topsoil. And without topsoil, you don't grow food. So then you have someone like Bill Gates opening up synthetic nitrogen fertilizer plants in Africa to help them, you know, with their food supply. So there is such ignorance in the system. And that's really what we're working on within the NGOs, you know, and within this whole movement, like Kiss the Ground movie and you know, so many initiatives right now to educate everyone, the public, because we as consumers have to know that. You know, we have to understand as consumers where our food is coming from. And where these pathologies originate, the mess this has created is beyond comprehension.
Yeah, I've worked in government long enough to know that when you're in a large corporation or organization, it is very difficult to bring in new ways of doing things. You know, especially when an industry is so set in its ways and very. Very locked into that. So I have a lot of empathy for your situation there. And it was a really big light bulb moment for me when you were talking about how all of these restaurants are offering the same food, but packaged a little differently, because I was kind of under the spell thinking that there is diversity of options, but you kind of broke that illusion for me, because it really is like an illusion of choice. But when you actually look at it, it really is the same thing that's just being offered in many different restaurants, just under different names. So that is incredibly interesting. And another thing I was thinking about is it's not just ancient cultures that were doing the regenerative agriculture, but I also think of George Washington Carver. Do you know him? Because he was an early I think in like the Civil War time, he was introducing like cover crops and more sustainable, holistic ways of farming as well, in the States. So that's but you talked about consumer behavior, and I did want to ask you about that. How important do you feel that people's choices actually impact the supply chain?
Oh, profoundly, profoundly so. The thing is that consumers get their information from advertising mostly, and these soda companies and fast food companies and junk food companies are spending billions of dollars in advertising. You have six corporations that own and control 90% of the US media, so there is no information coming through to the consumer that really alerts them to the reason why you have diabetes or why you're obese or why you have cancers and so on. The medical system is not dealing with root cause. It's a patch-up, fix-it system, as opposed to, I mean, every day you turn around, there's another diabetes truck. Whereas the drug for diabetes is food. Just change your diet and your diabetes will be gone in like 80% of the cases. So this whole machine there, has to really change, and it has to start with the consumer understanding that what I put in my mouth determines my health. I mean, my God, it was like Socrates, right? Let your food be your medicine and let your medicine be your food. It's like 2,500 years ago they knew that. And we have lost this connection to food. Now in old cultures, like the Jewish culture, the German culture, the Chinese have a recipe for everything. They are obsessed with what they eat. A lot of it is superstition and nonsense, but they're obsessed with the food they put in their mouth because they see the link to health through it. And once the consumer starts pressuring, demanding different types of food, fresh food, healthy food, nutrients-rich food, then the supply chain will respond to that because you have so many entrepreneurs, young startups, there's so much innovation in the system to make that happen. But it starts with educating consumers on really understanding why we are so sick. I mean, we have 70% of Americans have a underlying condition, whether that's diabetes, obesity, or cancers, or heart disease. 40% have two or more. We are so sick as a culture, right? Caused by this insane food system.
I struggle with my own personal choice in food, and I wanted to get your thoughts on this. I think of my own choice. There's a gradient between just eating everything you want, what's fed to us, and not thinking about it at all. And then you can go all the way across, into eating local, eating vegetarian, and then to the more extreme levels of being vegan, or going to the point where you just starve yourself in the name of the environment. So I'm wondering, how do you, in your own personal choices for food, balance that gradient of trying to be healthy yourself, but also think of the environment? Like, where do you land in it, and what do you think is the best choices that consumers can make in order to promote regenerative agriculture?
So I would point you towards Harvard University here. When you go online, you type in menus of change. Harvard University School of Public Health has created a partnership with the Culinary Institute of America. They have a wonderful website where you can download PowerPoint instructions and get their feedback, on basically they're calling it a plant-forward cuisine. The American diet, and so is the Australian and Canadian diet, is excessively focused on meat. Now, because that came through the pioneer days and first coming in here and shoot yourself a buffalo and so on, and then there was the total absence of kitchen equipment. So everything, every cut of meat that needed, let's say, an oven to that was turned into a hamburger and minced meat, because that was the only way they could process it. Now, so that stuck in the cultural meme, that we have around food. But this is really a wonderful a way to explain all these great cuisines. They're recommending a Mediterranean cuisine, but Indian cuisine is amazingly tasty, and rich in creativity. Chinese cuisine, Vietnamese, Japanese, I mean, they all eat healthy. And there's like so many, there's so many options to go by. It's still a little difficult because the supply chain is just now starting to come around and tie itself into this demand. Clearly, more and more people have this, I want to eat something healthy that makes me feel good. And actually, your body will adjust. When I first came to the United States, that was like 1975 as a student, I traveled. I thought I had no money, so I thought, let me just eat at McDonald's. That stuff is super cheap. And so I ate 3 days straight at McDonald's and I got sick. I got violently sick because my system, wasn't used to this. Mm-hmm. Having been raised in Germany and traveling all over Europe, I was eating healthy food. And so 3 days of that, and I was, remember that movie, Super Size Me?
Yeah.
That's exactly what happened to me. And so once you start eating fresh food, healthy food, you can't go back, because your body then rejects that. Because we have an innate health sense that guides us in this direction.
What is your opinion on meat eating in general?
Well, my opinion in general is that animals belong on the farm. They're an integral part of farming because you need the biomass that comes from animals on the soil. But they don't belong into a concentrated feeding operation where they are injected with prophylactic hormones and antibiotics and get violently sick before they get killed, because they're being fed with corn, which they're grass eaters. They don't eat corn, and so the animals that the meat that comes from these CAFO operations is not healthy, and it's devastating on the environment. Think about, they have pig farms that have like 50,000 animals in them, 60,000 animals in them. Each pig produces about three to five times the amount of sewage that a human being produces, right? And then they have no sewage system. They just dispose of this stuff, spray it out there into the open, where it becomes a toxin that pollutes our groundwater, pollutes the soil. And so it's an insanity. The entire system has gone insane. So my position on meat is, eat less meat, but eat the meat that you do buy. Make sure it's healthy meat. It comes from humanely raised, responsibly raised animals.
Yeah, and that's something that I like about the regenerative approach in general, is that it's a little more balanced, and I think that is probably more effective in bringing everyone together to advance that, because things like the vegetarian option can be very polarizing among large groups of people. So I do like the regenerative approach because it has something for everyone, I think, and can really resonate with people.
There is a PowerPoint presentation at the Menus of Change website that deals with that. So they're saying, we're basically plant forward. Plant forward can be vegan, it can be vegetarian, or it can be flexitarian. They don't call it omnivore anymore. They call it a flexitarian, will eat some meat. Mm-hmm. And, And so you need protein. Protein is a vitally important ingredient, nutrient that you need. But you need maybe 2 or 3 ounces of meat now to satisfy your protein needs. And we will, I mean, my gosh, you know, you get 10-ounce steaks and 8-ounce hamburgers now in the casual dining restaurants.
Yeah, that's good with to have that flexitarian option, because unfortunately, like everything nowadays, it's become so political to say what you eat in some circles, unfortunately. So it is good that this movement can have something for everyone. And I did want to ask, though, because you have so much experience globally, but specifically in Germany, how do you find the agriculture and food culture is different from in America?
So Germany, like any country in Europe or in Asia, has its food system, its menus adjusted seasonally to what is in season. So, for example, come May, there's the asparagus season. Everybody eats asparagus. You know, I mean, every restaurant you go to has asparagus on the menu. And beautiful, they have this white asparagus. It comes with drawn butter or hollandaise sauce. New potatoes that just come out of the ground, right? And so that's and then sometimes there's no meat at all, or they have like a little schnitzel with it. Every restaurant. So then by July, it's gone, right? Because now the asparagus season is over. So no one is importing now asparagus from wherever, right? It's that's that. Then come fall, you know, they're opening up game. Now you eat venison and boar and chanterelles, mushrooms, and so on. Then later in fall, you start eating cabbage. So even today, where it's not necessary, because you have this global supply chain, the German culture is in this rhythm of certain foods for certain seasons, which is something we have completely lost in the US. Everything is available anytime, right? I keep buying tomatoes, and I'm going, why am I buying tomatoes? This is not the season for tomatoes, you know? And they taste horrible. I mean, you can play ping pong with them. Yeah? We as a culture, you know, we have actually, I think, an exciting journey ahead of us, because, you know, food is so much color. It's so much joy, you know, the community and all of that. So if we just embrace the idea that food is life, and what we eat determines also the life of the soil where it comes from.
Yeah, that's something that I really do feel like we're missing in North America, is that food is just food. It's not culture. And I think that not making it culture, just seeing it as a transaction almost, really takes away a lot of what food should be. It should be like a celebration, and we should be more connected to what we are putting in our bodies, I think.
Yeah.
And I did want to pull out a little bit even more before we wrap up as well from Germany. How do you think India, China, Nigeria, these bigger countries are playing a role now in the future of either the regenerative movement or how they're going to be players in all of this?
Well, this is going global right now. I'm on the advisory board for an effort done by the United Nations that came through an organization called 4 per 1,000. If you go online to 4 per 1,000, now it's an initiative focused on the restoration of soil to sequester carbon out of the atmosphere. So the United Nations is calling for a 2021 food systems summit. And I was in a training session last week. There were 70 countries represented in that training session who have made a decision to shift their agricultural systems into regenerative. It was astounding. And the German delegation made a pitch to say that every European city should have a sister city in Africa to help them restore their, to help them create the infrastructure they need to become food independent, you know, create food sovereignty at community level, and help them to grow the right foods conducive for their culture, their soil, their water, their climate. So this is absolutely happening, which is also one reason why there is so much turmoil in the political process, because it's very challenging for these global corporate actors to deal with that. They're not set up to deal with this. The supply chain is not set up to deal with fresh local food. They want to have, you know, a 10,000-acre farm that produces, you know, one massive crop. So that is you can't stop this anymore. You know, it's happening. We just want to make sure it happens in a constructive, peaceful, you know, productive way, because this is a crazy time, and we can't really afford to have anything go wrong. You know, because climate change has grown exponential. You know, our impact on the environment is so devastating, and accelerating. I mean, there's one number that is sort of telling. We're currently using 1.7 times the reproductive capacity of the planet. By reproductive capacity, I mean, for example, we are draining aquifers beyond their replenishment rate. We are catching fish. We are depleting fish stocks beyond their reproductive capacity. So we are accelerating a decline. So we're using 1.7 times the reproductive capacity of the planet. We are today 7.8 billion people. When I was born in 1949, there were 2.4 billion. 1960s, 3 billion, 2000, 6 billion. You know, today we're at 7.8 billion. I wrote a PowerPoint last year that we were at 7.6 billion. So we're supposed to go to 8.6 billion by 2030, and then to somewhere near 10 billion by 2050. Well, we are depleting the ecological capital. You know, while we are depleting the ecological capital, we are increasing the demand on it, because more people need to eat, and cultures like the Chinese and other Middle Brazil and so on, they want to have more better food. Yeah, and so the pressure on the environment is enormous, and there isn't a whole lot of time left to turn that around. I mean, there really isn't.
Yeah, I think that the world is pretty exhausted by all of these challenges, these colossal challenges that we face. And something that's so refreshing about regenerative agriculture is that it's just a spark of some sort of practical solution that we can implement that could address not just one of the environmental degradation metrics that we face, but a wide range of all of them combined. It's very holistic. So it's very optimistic to hear that it is gaining so much traction. And I know that even within my own psyche, I'm hearing more and more about it, and it's becoming a louder and louder movement. So I really appreciate the work that you're doing to move it forward and help it be implemented. What is next for you and your involvement with it?
Well, we are. I'm working with the Kiss the Ground organization right now, who are producing this movie, and we will have a movie screening, and then followed by a panel discussion with Citizen Climate Lobby, and then with the Sierra Club. Citizen Climate Lobby, we're focusing on something very technical, which is carbon markets and how can they work? How can you pay farmers, you know, to convert regenerative methods, because for the farmer to shift, he may need different types of equipment. There is a temporary loss of yield, you know, as you are transitioning out of chemical fertilizers and pesticides, and you may have to change crop types. That means you have to find new markets for your product and so on. So there is a bill in Congress called the Growing Climate Solutions Act, which has the intention to pay farmers to put carbon into the ground. You know, because when the farmer puts carbon into the ground, you're rejuvenating the soil. It's automatic. So that means you have to use cover crops and no-till operations and rotate your crops and things like that. And then with the Sierra Club, we want to talk about what can we do individually. What can we do to help to bridge the link from farmer to my plate, because the farmer knows that I'm losing my soil the way I farm. I want to change. The consumer, I get sick from this food I'm eating, and I don't have fresh food around me. But in the middle, you have a supply chain, this corporate supply chain that is very rigid, and has an enormously difficult time to adjust to creating this link. So as individuals, we can supercharge this process by demanding different types of food to be on the shelf in my local grocery store or on the menu in the restaurant I like to frequent.
So what is your YouTube channel and how can people contact you?
Or if you just go on YouTube, type in Klaus Mega, my videos will pop up. I have one where I'm just explaining my journey, from my professional background to moving into a sustainability field. And then there are some presentations, some webinars I participated in that you have seen. So just type Klaus Mega on YouTube and you get there.
And did you have a Facebook page or email?
I have a Facebook page. It's called Growing a Revolution.
Great. All right. Well, Klaus, thank you so much for your time today. You're incredibly articulate. You're doing very important work. Also, I find it hugely inspiring to contribute after your retirement, and I hope that I can find that type of motivation after I retire as well. So thank you for inspiring us all and for doing the important work that you do. It was an honor.
Well, thank